The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, The Queens of Jihad, was recorded at The Guardian in July 2015. The chair, Tazeen Ahmed.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this Guardian Live event. I'm Tazeen Ahmed. It's the Queens of Jihad, although we have some Kings of Jihad on here too. So let me tell you a little bit about tonight's debate. I'm a reporter, writer, and documentary maker, and I've been doing this for about 20 years. And over the last 20 years, I've covered multiple stories around radicalization, extremism, and terrorism. The young British men who went to Afghanistan to fight and ended up in Guantanamo Bay, the infamous radicals who influenced them and thousands of others, schools where children were being taught a very sinister and dangerous ideology. And I reported also the rise of Al-Qaeda, worked on September 11th when that happened, and also when bin Laden was assassinated. I went to Pakistan to cover that story. I've met and interviewed a number of those notorious British preachers who persuaded young men, and as we know now, women, to join jihad. And I was always struck by their charisma, their intelligence, and their sense of humor, and I think you'll notice that tonight too. I hosted a debate series for Channel 4, which I hope we can revive, called Sharia TV, around about 8 years ago. It had a graveyard slot, but the one thing I remember about it, we spoke only to Muslims, young Muslims, and I do remember they were very frustrated and very angry. So I know the story well, but I remained very much focused on the sort of stories I've told you. And I was questioning myself tonight about why it was that I haven't covered the role of women extensively. I've done a documentary or two around women, but not really in the way that we've been talking about in the last couple of years. And I think the reason for that was because the voice of women was often deemed to be either passive or disapproving. And I think it's far more nuanced than that, as we've discovered. This past year has shocked and alarmed us all as British mothers, young women, teenage girls have got on flights and travelled to one of the most dangerous parts of the world to join jihad. Some have even taken their children. Of the estimated 700 Britons who've gone to Syria, we know that about 100 of them have been women and girls. Are they victims? Have they been coerced? Have they been groomed? Are they deluded? Are they longing for adventure? Is it Islam or escape from an unbearable life here? Or the search for a better life over there, an existential crisis or an identity crisis? So tonight's event, which we're going to aim to answer some of those questions, I spoke to a lawyer friend of mine yesterday, and he said, I want you to give me one answer, just one simple thing. And I think we're not going to get that tonight. There'll be lots of things. But let me introduce you to my incredible panel. So two Muslim women who we will call Yasmin and Salma to protect their identity and the work they do. So that is Salma in the end. She looks like a Saudi princess, but she's just trying to protect her ID. And this is Yasmin to my left. Both of them are former radicals who now work to prevent other women from joining Islamist movements. As I said, please don't take any pictures of Salma. It's in order to protect her work. Ali Askermani to my right is a counselor, imam, and he works to de-radicalize young people. He too is a former extremist, so understands this mindset well. And Shiraz Maher, second to my left, a writer and senior fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization, also a former extremist. So you will hear a very unique perspective tonight. And also Melanie Smith on the end, who is a researcher who specialized in ISIS and women and is from the Institute of Strategic Dialogue and will give us some context. So let's just thank you, all of you, for being here. Let's just start with questions. And later on, perhaps in the middle, there will be lots of opportunities for your questions too. So you've all turned your back on extremism and now work in different environments to try and prevent others from doing so. Salma, can you just start very briefly and tell us a little bit about your story?
Well, in the late 90s and the whole of the noughties, 2000s, I was part of a radical group, you could say, and I was quite a high-profile member of of it happened to be Hizbut Tahrir, but I did used to hang out with Anjum Chowdhury's family as well, and I basically used to promote the concept of Islamic State, Khilafah, and used to spend my time recruiting young women. And I actually ended up on your Sharia TV program way back and the audience because I was quite an active member of HT, and it was somewhere I wanted to be, on, you know, in the media promoting ideas and meeting other Muslims. So I remember making an effort to go to attend Sharia TV when I was part of this group. So I spent 10 years of my life in this group, and I ended up having a reassessment around, you know, after 10 odd years in it, and completely switched and turned tables, and now I work to, you know, de-radicalise young women.
Thank you so much. Yasmin, can you tell us your story?
I think my story is just a little bit different. I obviously had a bit of a rough childhood, but then I found this particular group that did break away from Hizbut Tahrir in the late 1996 to be a bit more appealing. It was a bit more active. At that time, it was quite fresh because the situations in Bosnia had then ended, the conflict in Bosnia, and we also had the ongoing issues in Gaza, in Palestine, and also Somalia, what was happening. So the group that I joined was something that promised the Islamic State. And they manipulated a Quranic verse, which then pulled us into thinking that we are going to be the God's representative, we are going to be the radical reformers of the century, the fact that we are going to implement a system which is implemented by God, and therefore a system that has been created by God is definitely going to benefit mankind. We learned about the golden years of when the Jewish, the Christians and the Muslims lived together. So that was really appealing. The fact of, you know, science had, you know, Islam had really contributed to science. So imagine that this was a vision that we wanted. But then when we came into this group, I wasn't a high profile. We were probably the grassroots recruiters. My job in my area was to recruit female, and that was by missionary stalls and also to gatecrash some circles. And we were definitely against the Hizbut Tahrir. So that is something. It's nice to see my sister and me sitting together today and actually exchanging, because there was no way we would sit together at that time. Yes.
And here we are.
And here we are. So at that time, yes, we were very active. We remembered Rally for Islam in central London at that time. And that was something we were going to get our message out to the world. So what we were preparing was to get a lot of the recruits from outside, mothers, sisters, whoever it was, even converts, and to make them part of this group, and then to create an exodus. Wherever the Islamic State was going to be established, we were then going to give our allegiance to this caliph. Now, this was the public sphere, but in the private sphere, spiritually, we were dead. Most of us women felt that Islam was going, and things were not sounding right, especially when the leaders started talking about offensive jihad, which, as a matter of fact, for chance, jihad has been taken totally differently. The word is qital, killing. So therefore, we started questioning, well, what is this party for? Whose dirty job am I doing? We couldn't trust our local female sisters, so I had to make friends with the outer lot, with the outer sisters in different regions. And it struck me, there were three things that made me come out. One thing was the way they were manipulating text, because at that time, luckily, I was studying about Islam anyway. So the narratives of what the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, or the Quranic text, was actually going against what they were actually teaching. And there was just political. Forget about Quran, forget about your prayers. It was the Islamic State. So anyway, the three significant things that actually made me switch my head was one, where a sister said to me that anything that is affecting your iman, meaning your faith, is definitely not coming from Islam. That was number one. Number two was where I was actually put on the spot to actually explain how would Islamic State run, how would you implement it, and that's when I thought, I'm stuck here. And the third thing was, I think, where it was just the whole thing of whose dirty work am I doing? Me and my husband, we were just functioning. We were both together in this group. It was just a cult. Everything was controlled. What you wear, what you read, what you watch. It was just a cultic.
Okay, we'll talk. More of those details in a bit. Aliaz, what brought you to extremism?
Do you know what's interesting? I never described myself as an extremist, and not that I'm in denial. Certainly not. Okay, when you are, you know, I just happen to be in an extremist group, and I think all of us can relate to the fact that at some point in our lives, we've been parts of groups or we've been part of a group think and we haven't challenged it due to lots of factors. The inability to assert ourselves in front of very charismatic and powerful leaders. I always say, you know, I'm sure there are people in the Conservative Party who are sitting down thinking, what the fuck am I doing here in this particular party? I don't believe this kind of stuff, yeah, but people do that. And you know what, when I look back, I just happened to be with this group of guys. And you know what? They were, you know, we were brothers, we were comrades, there was this real sense of wanting to change the world. I was always an activist, I was an anti-racist activist. And so for me, it was much more about being a vanguard that is, you know, young people want to change the world, and that was what it was about. And that we were special and we were significant. But it was also about counterculture, you know, it was escaping a particular culture and wow, this new way of expressing themselves. And, you know, there were lots of Islamic groups at the time. I didn't want to choose, I chose the worst one, okay, the most extreme at the time. Because, you know, when I think about it, and I think it's an element of what's happening today, because we're just repeating the whole cycle, it, you know, really it was the biggest two fingers I could stick up to everyone. You know, it really, there was lots of anger there. You know, and it's interesting, the order of the two fingers that I'm sticking up to people. One is my family, okay, my dad in particular. He doesn't like to hear that, okay, but, you know, it's a big two fingers up at my dad. You know, and the rejection of everything that my dad represented. I always took the reproach in life that I do the opposite to my dad. Okay, and a lot of this is about searching for father figures, because I found a father figure who just happened to be another tyrant, actually. And then you realize that as you go through the process, because there is a sell by date. You know, there is a kind of shelf life to the whole process as you see the contradictions and the hypocrisy slowly unravel. So it was a big two fingers to my dad, and it was a big two fingers towards the Islamic mainstream as well, to imams, to mosques. It's bizarre that I'm an imam now. And lots of young people come and stick their two fingers at me now, so which is a kind of interesting full circle. So it was a two fingers at these imams who I found completely passive, backwards, regressive, no kind of embracing the real challenges of the world, passive and inactive in terms of what was going on a global level, not speaking my own language, not understanding my reality, all of those kind of things. So a big two fingers up at them. But then there was the other interesting two fingers, because, you know, I'm bizarrely one of what I call it Rushdie's children. Okay. In 1989, I was quite oblivious and running away from Islam as far as I could possibly go. And then the inconvenience of Rushdie happened. I was at Glasgow University and I was forced. This is the whole thing. I had no interest in Islam. I was forced to look at my Islamic identity. And this is the push factors now. You know, for the first time, people are asking me to make a choice. And they're asking me to make a choice us and them. And I said, why should I? I've been with you guys for years and years. You know who I am. You know my liberal credentials. Yet you're still not prepared to accept me for what I am. So there was a real significant push there. So it was a big two fingers up at all that kind of middle class crowd at university who weren't. And all of them abandoned me, you know, when I started to not go to the nightclub, started to go to the mosque. Only one friend stayed behind, interestingly. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of factors. So. Yeah. I didn't buy into the ideology because, you know, I think all of us, we have this inner kind of voice. We have that moral compass. We do have a sense of right and wrong, and we see hypocrisy. But it's the confidence of young people and enabling them to really stand up to that and assert themselves to very charismatic males. I do a lot of thought experiments with the young people that I work with, which is about equipping them to deal with those kind of particular challenges. And it's difficult in that group situation to challenge the group think.
Okay, so Aliaz, I'm going to get you stopped now, because we need to move on.
Yeah.
Shiraz, how long were you involved with extremism?
I was also in Hizb ut-Tahrir. I was in Hizb ut-Tahrir for 4 years. But as I was listening to Aliaz, there's so many points of similarity, actually. Mm. So I won't necessarily sort of tell my story, as it were, but I'll pick up on some of the things I thought were really interesting. I joined in the immediate aftermath of September the 11th. And as you say, you're forced to make that choice. There's a point here. Now, it wasn't my sort of university friends. It was George Bush, right? You're with us, you're against us. And so I'm thinking, well, I'm not with you. And therefore, if I have to be against you, so be it. And you meet a group like Hizb ut-Tahrir in that moment of crisis. And really 9/11 was a shocking sort of world-defining event in terms of what it had done. And so in that context, you're looking at that, and you would think intuitively that most people would run away from radical groups in that context. Why would you be going towards them? But that's exactly the time a movement like Hizb ut-Tahrir was growing. When you look at Islamic State today, people say, well, how can people be going there? There's such a crisis taking place. That's the moment at which you're needed the most. That's the moment at which you can really affect the greatest change. And this comes back to something you were saying in terms of, you know, you have that sense in your head, we're creating something. We're going to create a new history. We're going to change the world. We're going to establish something that is truly revolutionary. And once you get into that mindset, you act like any totalitarianist and revolutionary who believes that ultimately I can create nirvana for everybody, right? Just let me get on with it and don't get in the way. If you get in the way, I have to kill you because you're now the impediment to everyone's happiness. So I, as I say, joined Hizb ut-Tahrir and rose the ranks over the course of my 4 years in the movement. And, you know, these groups, besides the ideology, they do provide, again, what Ilyas was talking about, lots of sort of group structure, lots of close friendships, lots of socialization. One of my old comrades and friends from them, Rashad, is sitting just here, in fact. And, you know, we could tell you so many crazy tales about, you know, all kinds of nonsense that we were getting up to across, and I mean literally across the whole of the north of England, because that was our patch and that was the area where we were trying to recruit people. And given the density of Muslims in places like Bradford and Sheffield and stuff, we were, you know, really busy. So in that context, I eventually moved away from the north. I moved down to Cambridge, and I actually lived with and was very close to the two guys that ended up bombing Glasgow Airport. I'd already left the radical world by that time. But it's just giving you a sense of how, you know, you go from being quite a normal, ordinary person to suddenly mixing with two guys who are prepared to blow themselves up, who tried to kill hundreds of people in London, of course, at Tiger Tiger, and then had gone up to Glasgow.
Okay.
So, sorry?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm going to move on now.
Yeah,
but you guys have obviously made a very good case for your credentials as former extremists. Melanie, tell us a little bit about your research into women and ISIS. What do we know about who's gone and why they've gone?
I'm afraid that I don't have quite as interesting a story, so I won't bore you with my very mundane life so far. So my research consists of maintaining and expanding a database of women who are known to be in ISIS territory. And they are women from all across the West. So that includes all of Western Europe, a little bit of Eastern Europe, the US, Australia, and Canada. And as of this morning, we have 119 individuals, and they are found and profiled on the basis of their social media accounts. So that information is archived and analyzed to pick out certain trends, to understand the movement as a whole, but also to understand the variety of individuals that we have, and to understand what makes people go and how they can differ from one another. The age range is about 14 to 46, so a very large group of individuals, very kind of all-encompassing. They could be pre-GCSE to postgraduate level, can come from very small, very conservative families to a convert who comes from a very large British family. So I think that's really testament to the variety of people that we're seeing going, which is what makes this.
Yeah, and that figure of 119 is just what we know. We were discussing this earlier. You said you were telling me about a number of families that just aren't reporting their daughters are missing.
Well, yeah, well, a little bit why I know those that information is because I work on the Channel programme, and if somebody's flagged up with having extremist views, or, you know, somebody's concerned, then they ask me to come and speak with them. And I speak to a variety of mainly young girls. The youngest has been 13 years old. These girls have either talking in a radical manner, or some girls have actually been stopped off the plane on the way to Syria. So they come, you know, I manage to speak with them and see what's happening. So one particular girl was flagged up, and it turned out that her sister had gone, but the family didn't notify anyone, and they kept saying that she'd gone to Lebanon and she was married to someone there, but in actual fact she was a recruiter in Syria. So we have a lot of families understandably not saying that their daughters have gone.
So what are the reasons they're giving for not reporting their daughters missing?
Well, none have actually given, but it's kind of
what you deduce.
A given that I've deduced that they don't want police involved in their life. They don't want to make the situation worse. They're frightened. They're not sure who to go to. They might make the situation a lot more worse than it is. If they've got contact from their daughter in Syria who keeps saying, I'm married, I'm safe, then that's all they can hope for.
Yasmin, what's your experience of working with young women?
I think what it is, obviously now I'm not working with young girls or young women because I'm doing more of like insight to why female do get recruited. But in the past, we had some really good organisations that got young Muslim females together. And part of it was to do with the identity, how they were perceived. I think there was an element where they weren't really cohesive with the, you know, there wasn't an element where they were actually integrating well. So they would only sort of stick to their own kind of groups within our, this was within our area. So what we actually did, we actually implemented an organization. What they needed was a channel where they can actually vent their frustrations. Now, whether that was, you know, like with the media, get some media workshop on how they were being portrayed, how do you train them? They were saying, look, we don't have any facilities. How do we get our point across? You know, so this was something that they felt. They felt that the whole world was against them because of the fact that they were Muslims. And it was just like, you know, they felt quite sort of isolated. And we had to bring them back. That was when we had funding. Mm. So what we did was to get organizations down. We actually had a really good one with the majority of young people where we actually invited the American embassy down. And this was a really good platform for them to really, you know, vent their frustrations about the Arab Spring. This is what they needed. They wanted to have that engagement with the officials. Mm. If you have something like that, then you will take that heat away from such ISIS propaganda.
And but there's more to it than that, isn't there? Because you were working with the women, the women's families in Bradford who travelled with their children, which was one of the most shocking developments we've seen over the last 6 months to a year. The women who left their families behind and travelled. Sorry, took their families with them and travelled.
Yeah. So I represent the whole of the north, everything outside of London. Look, what's interesting, I find in this whole debate, and I think the Bradford women's case is an example of that, is that somehow we've kind of like treated the women very differently from the men as well. The women are somehow victims of grooming, or they're susceptible, or they have multiple vulnerabilities, that the men are just bad. You know, either we recognise all the young people as kind of exploited and manipulated, or, you know, it's interesting how we kind of, it's almost, I think it's almost very, even the term jihadi bride I don't like, because I think the judge is quite sexist and actually reinforces lots of the kind of stereotypes that we have around the kind of Arab men, Muslim men, and their vociferous sexual appetites and things like that. Women act on their own agency just like men. That's the whole thing for multiple reasons. And I think one of the aspects of the Bradford story, I don't think that's kind of come forward in the kind of media, knowing the area, living two streets away from them, knowing the family actually, is that, you know, what we have in Britain and it's not unique to Muslims, are young people who and people who live in what I call one square mile. Their whole experience is just that thing. They're profoundly unworldly and they're repressed and they're controlled. You know, the three girls were British born, very articulate, educated, had enormous potential, no doubt. Yet they came from a very austere, socially conservative family that kept them in. I asked people on the same street, did you see the girls? They said, no, they never came out. Okay, so that shows they were from a Pathan background, from people from the northwestern frontier of Pakistan, very socially conservative, and they have that kind of very kind of controlling aspect to that. Then they're married to men, obviously from Pakistan, from the clan, no doubt. No, they didn't have much of a choice, I would say, in that. Marrying men that they're not happy with, profoundly discontented in their relationships, men who are not enabling them to grow or anything like that. So one of the bizarre aspects of this is that it's bizarre that in parts of Britain we have situations like this where young people have even less freedom and are constrained in a particular kind of prison, you could say, and that somehow ISIS offers them empowerment and emancipation and liberation from that they saw more freedom, more ability to have freedom of expression, although, again, they're seduced by the, you could say, the quite compelling kind of media machine that they have and kind of like narrative that they have. But they saw more freedom there. They saw that as a better environment than bringing them up where I live in Bradford, which is a bit of a ghetto in that particular area, lots of drug dealers in the area, very high crime rates, three generations of worklessness, you know, some real serious kind of social issues that they saw bringing up their children in the Islamic State, much more progressive, forward-thinking, empowering, than the reality in the UK.
Which is shocking.
Can I just say, I can totally, in that, from that perspective, as a woman, back when I had that type of mentality, I can relate to why they went. In the sense, yeah, there's all the problems here, but it's this, I used to call myself a fish out of water. The scriptural justifications that I used to adhere to and the convictions that I had in them, I felt I couldn't live in this country anymore. It would be something that would be allowed for me to do. And that would, way back, I would have totally have gone in the exact same way as they would have with their children and have set up life there. And what I understand from the propaganda is like, here's a house, here's your benefits, here's schooling. You know, I used to write for a magazine called The Kill Alpha Magazine way back. And I remember writing for this magazine and saying this exact thing, that I feel jealous that I can't take my children to the local school because it's not Islamic. So, you know, that's the poison that was in my mind, believing that I can't live here. And I felt suffocated and I couldn't live here, so I had to leave. And this place is the Islamic State. This is where what I've been waiting for all those years. Mm. And so I would have, if I was them, if that mentality have gone as well.
So if you're understanding, Shiraz, lack of belonging, the allure of the Islamic State, identity issues and family issues, the sort of backgrounds that Alias has just talked about, is that all at play and is there more?
That's all really important. And, you know, the public debate, you'll have seen David Cameron's speech a few days ago. The public debate tries to make this issue very polarized. You know, it's all about ideology. It's got nothing to do with ideology. It's all about this. The reality is, with everyone, there are multiple factors at play all the time. I personally think identity is a huge issue. It clearly plays a massive role in the life of every individual in terms of finding your place in the world, finding, you know, what it is that is going to give your life meaning. And for a lot of young British Muslims, we're very confused about where we fit in and how we live in this society. And so when something comes along like Islamic State, it is very empowering. It's very empowering in two ways. The first is that it offers you something by way of identity that is that transcends culture, right? So you say, am I British? Am I Pakistani? Am I this? Am I that? They come along, they sort of say, here's an intellectual identity. It transcends culture. You're a Muslim. That's really empowering, particularly when you put it alongside all their propaganda. So we have all these debates. What does it mean to be British? We're unsure about what it means to be British. Well, Islamic State's coming along and saying, look, we're really self-confident. We know exactly what we stand for. We know exactly what we want to offer. And you too can be a part of this. All you have to do is make hijrah, right? Make the migration, come out here and be part of it. And so that is empowering for everybody as a whole, but for women in particular, as you were saying, Ilyas, who are coming from very socially conservative backgrounds, how do you bargain and negotiate your way out? Well, you're doing it now from a premise where your parents are sort of nominally Muslim and sort of have a sort of at least culturally Muslim backgrounds, and you're saying, look, I'm the better Muslim. I'm going off to live in Islamic State. So you're not arguing with them on some basis that's completely alien to them, sort of liberalism or something like that. You're saying, look, I've gone this way. But it's allowed you to rebel. And this has come back to something we were discussing before. It gives you something to rebel against, but it gives you the platform to rebel against that your parents can understand. And I'll just stop with this last point, which is I want to reiterate it. Because I kind of felt Ilyas was stealing my thunder when he said it, which is the whole narrative in the public discourse has been very, very patronizing towards the women. The jihadi bride stuff, brainwashed, groomed, is all nonsense. Our center, ICSR, it's an academic center based at King's College. Melanie used to work with us, I should just point this out, and now does all the women's stuff. We've interviewed about 100 foreign fighters out there with Islamic State and so on. Done a few interviews with the women. The women are incredibly ideological. A lot of the guys, you can tell, are idiots. I mean, they, to put it very, very bluntly, right? They are. They're attracted to the macho nurses, but the women have really given it much more sober thought. They really have understood the concept of Khilafah, what it stands for and what's going on, and have made a very, very conscious choice, in many cases much more conscious, much more deliberate than the men. So,
sure, just to build on that point, sorry, Tazim. You see, it's interesting. We've missed this. We've just completely kind of missed this one out. You know, if we go back to 7/7, Jamal Lindsay, obviously one of the bombers, he was a student of mine for a period of time. And then he left me, and he married Samantha Lethwaite. And of course, we didn't think that Samantha Leatherwaite had any involvement at all in his so-called radicalization. You know, we didn't have, even all the security forces had, you know, they're oblivious of the fact. And then it later on emerged because, again, information that I got from very close sources that actually she was instrumental, integral in the whole process of radicalizing Jamal Lindsay. And there was a fact, there was a sense that it was a traditional model of Abdullah al-Faisal, who was the ideologue at the time, had that significant role. But no, she was a key driver in this whole process. And we kind of like completely just kind of like, kind of missed that one out.
So is it our stereotype about Muslim women that's left so many of us on the back foot when this all emerged in the last year? Because obviously people like Salma were involved with these movements, so were you. Yasmin, that's to you.
Oh, sorry.
That was to you.
Could you just rephrase this question?
Yeah, I was just saying that is it our stereotype about Muslim women that makes it so that's left us all sort of caught in the back foot about this?
I think there's an understanding as well, and this is, I've got to be absolutely blunt here. There's this, the way I see it, I think we really lack our education about Khawarijism. If we don't know our history about this cult, then we won't know how to tackle this problem. I think there's another factor which we keep on forgetting, is that these women are, some of them probably have this perception that the Armageddon is near because of the way this text has been misconstrued. So therefore, this is one of the reasons why. I think for us, what we need to do is to really get our foot grip into this ideology, which I don't believe is Islamist or Wahhabism. It actually emerges from Khawarijism, which is dated back from the 7th century. And that was based on rebellion.
Are those teenage girls who travelled to Syria, are they aware? Are they thinking about the scriptures, or are they just seeking adventure or a better life?
I think it's probably not about adventure. It could be the Armageddon, because you remember this is Syria. What's happening in Syria? There's so much possible points that Syria could be the point where everything's going to take place, where, say, for example, the Antichrist is going to come. But there's also an element of seeing that I want to be in a place where I'm going to be protected now. It's an honor issue. Being part of the Islamic so-called state is to be part of an honor protection. I am going to be protected. The West cannot harm me. So there's that Western phobia that also comes in. So there's this perception that we are going to, I think it's more to do with this utopian and supremacist belief that we are better than everyone and we are going to dominate. You know, the so-called deen in their context is going to dominate the world. And this, if you look into the research of the old history of Khawarijism, it actually goes into that, where they even thought that Ali radiallahu anhu, the companion, was, he was a disbeliever. So we've got to know our history if we're going to tackle this problem.
So using those scriptures and understanding our history would be a good tool to use.
Of course, and understanding of the cult.
Can I make a point on that history thing? Syria roared into everyone's consciousness around 2012, 2013. That conflict started, obviously, in 2011. But this whole issue, when you roll it back, you have to understand it from the mindset of these young people. For British Muslims, the whole issue of Khilafah, this background noise, this discussion, has been going on for decades. It started in the 1980s. It picked up in the 1990s. After 9/11, it really was the sort of main discourse within the British Muslim community. Khilafah coming soon to a state near you, is Khilafah an obligation? So that was the debate I remember in the mid and early 1990s. What is this thing, an Islamic state? Is it an obligation for us to have one? What does it look like? What should it be like? That was the discussion. By the end of the 1990s, that was not the debate that would take place in mosques anymore. That debate had been won. The debate was, how do you establish the Khilafah? What is the method for bringing it into being? I.e., we'd already established that principle. We need a Khilafah, right? We're just waiting here, essentially in a hotel, until we can go to the lobby and check out when the Khilafah is established. Now, none of us actually have gone there. But when I'm talking to some of these guys, I'm talking like a 19-year-old guy or an 18-year-old guy who's out there fighting. He's grown up with this. He's born in 1995, born in 1994. The whole mood music to their life in this country, when they go to the mosque, when they live within our communities, has been this notion that, the Khilafah. So it makes complete sense that when this thing gets established out in Syria and Iraq, and this guy says, I'm the Khalif, you sit there and think, well, I'm a hypocrite if I stay.
It's a good point and very interesting, but I'd like to bring it back to women.
That's where the women have gone.
A women point, right? A female point.
Yeah, female point, totally.
Did you want to make...
Oh, right.
Yes, go for it. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No. From my work that I do, I've been in touch with at least 30-odd young women. The girls that I'm working with at the moment are from the Bethnal Green School, so they were direct friends of the girls that left three big famous images. And, you know, this is a learning thing for all of us. There's not one answer to any of this. But what I'm trying to decipher is what are the trends, what are the things that we can tackle. So the group of girls, they're like between 13 to 15-year-olds at school. So I'm asking them, what was it that made your friends leave? What do you think? And the common answer is they were curious. The media are going on about ISIS all the time. They don't know what's happening. They went and had a look on the media, on the internet. And that curiosity then drew them in, because ISIS are there waiting, fishing for the curious girls. And they don't have the intellectual understanding of Khilafah and Khawarij. Like, they're 15. They're just little babies in my eyes. What is it that's drawing them in? One trend is that they are very clever. They're all like A-grade students.
Yeah.
So they've got that the activist mentality that you're supposed to have when you're at university, but they've got it already, you know, in GCSEs level. So they want a cause. They find these things upsetting. They want to solve the problem. So they've got this this desire to change the world, and it is a mix. Some of them, I'm sad to say, but some of them are under the category of jihadi bride.
So let's talk about the jihadi bride issue, because that's hit the headlines over and over again.
It's not for everyone, but I'm saying some of them have been lured in by attractive men.
Right, okay. So I sat at The Guardian a couple of months ago and held a panel, which Rashad was also on the panel here. And at the time, there were all men on the panel apart from me, and they all were insistent that the reason why women were going were because there were these really hunky guys in Syria. I didn't buy it.
The sad reality is when they get out there, the guys ain't that good looking.
I didn't order that one.
And they're not even that good looking from over here. But
Girls don't know that.
Wow, this is...
You sort of know what you're getting into, but so I just wondered, can we just deal with that once and for all? Melanie, what's the real reason they're going?
From my experience, which obviously isn't interaction as such, but just observation, there's a lot of talk about the female-specific things, and we have to understand this as a completely different issue, really. I know we've been saying, and that is a massive problem for me, the way that the women that have been joining ISIS are dealt with, particularly by the media. I feel awful saying that, being here, but it's true. We have this element of being so shocked, and women are not new to terrorism. Throughout modern history, you look at the PLO, you look at Sri Lanka, you look at Chechnya, women have been involved and taken an active role in so many conflicts. And now we have actually, with Islamic State, they're not taking an active role militarily. They're not allowed to fight. They're prohibited from fighting completely. That might change, but from the last 2-3 years, that's been the rule. So what we're having is something that's majorly attractive without that military element, without that kind of physical violence. What was my point? So the female-specific things, we have these things like belonging, and that comes from the identity complex that we're seeing here. You know, all of these questions that come out when you're 15, 16 of, for these women, what does it mean to be a Muslim? What does it mean to be British? What does it mean to potentially be Pakistani, Somalian, Ethiopian in terms of heritage? What does it mean to be in a society where women are actually quite sexualized and that's kind of shoved down your throat a lot? And what does it mean to actually try and take on that modesty, and how is that debated in the public? So you have all of these questions going on, and sometimes the reasons that people go can be really simple. And they can be things like, I didn't have many friends at school, and I see all of these women and they have this community and everybody's the same. And there's all of this propaganda around sisterhood. And creating that community.
Totally.
It's a very strong thing.
And is that also the obligation? Isn't that also part of the obligation that you need to go in order to support the sisterhood? Mm. What do you think about the jihadi bride issue?
I think sometimes what we do is we exceptionalise Muslims, and I don't. I humanise the situation. Muslims do things for the same reasons as anyone else. It just manifests itself in something completely different. And these narratives and these dynamics have existed for millennia. And when you look at the gender dynamics of conflict, it's actually a lot to do with masculinity. What you actually have is a clash of masculinities, what we call heroic masculinity. It began with, obviously, George Bush versus Osama bin Laden. And much of this is about who remasculinizing men, okay? And then the power to remasculinize is also to then feminize women in your image. That's part of the whole process. I see it with gang dynamics with the gang kids that I work with. If I can describe one of the dynamics, when one gang takes the women of another gang, that accentuates their power. So then they show the jewelry and the clothing of the women they've taken to the other gang because they've emasculated them. And essentially, that's part of this whole process. Women, there is an element of women doing it because they are driven by the same agency as men. They want to change the world. But then there is also this other overriding dynamic around masculinity, and I've spoken a lot about this, because I want to get away from the fact that this is actually something to do with Islam and Muslims necessarily. It's about the same dynamics as anyone else. Now, following on from the kind of whole masculinity analysis as well, part of that whole problem, what accentuates, what gives you power, and if you look at the dynamics, that America was attacked, that emasculated America. The war on terror then is an attempt to reassert that kind of masculinity. The whole desire, ISIS kind of thrive on it, with the young men are driven by this idea of bravery, heroism. It's all from the Iliad anyway. If people remember the Iliad, it's more or less the same kind of dynamics in that. And part of what gives the power to the men is the ability to possess and control women. So that's kind of part of the dynamic. And I think that's why the women then eventually see the hypocrisy and the contradiction of what drives it. But unfortunately, we're dealing with a lot of children here. This is the other dimension that I've been quite kind of annoyed about in terms of this whole debate. We're talking about children. Mm. We're talking about children who are just completely naive in terms of theology, know very little about Islamic theology, leave alone on specialist subjects on the fiqh of jihad, on the jurisprudence of fighting and governance and things like that. And yet our governments turned their backs on them completely and demonized them and vilified them and forsaken any kind of redemption or return compared to other governments. We have a responsibility to these kids.
But, and these young girls, they're clever young girls, as we mentioned earlier, 28 GCSEs between a set of twins. They've got bright futures ahead of them. What on earth would possess them to go to a foreign land, a place that seemed where the worst, most evil, ideologies at play?
But you see it as evil. You see it as wicked and tumultuous. But for them, this is the promised land. This is the Khilafah. This is everything that they've been told about. And that sense of belonging, that sense of I'm at peace here, I'm at security here, all of that, I get it when they say it, because they no longer have to wrestle with this issue of, are you this, are you that? I'm a Muslim, I'm part of this. And it's really important, actually, to understand in this context, the role of the women, as Millie's mentioning, they don't go out and fight on the front lines. It's not part of the sort of repertoire for them in the way that women have fought in other terrorist movements. For Islamic State, they're saying, we are a state. And that's always been their mindset. So they're even saying to men who can't fight, so you should come here. You need to just be here, be on the soil. And it's about two things for the women and for the state as a whole. It's about achieving a critical mass of people who are laying down roots on that soil so that when there is a revanchist campaign to take all this land back, it's going to be that much harder because you've already put in place all these things. And they've clearly done that. They've put in so many people into that land. Not all of them fighters, but they've built a civil society of their own and a sort of functioning quasi-state. The second thing is the role of the women in that capacity then is to have children, to raise those children. There's been a lot of talk, so-called ISIS cubs. And that's the whole issue here. It's to raise the next generation of fighters because they're saying, right, if we're going to be under attack, we're going to need to have a new generation that will take this issue forward. We've seen the children of fighters from France and places like that executing prisoners of war in Islamic State. So this is that's obviously being taught.
And is that the reason, Yasmin, in your view, that ISIS is specifically targeting women?
I think obviously they know that women are passive, and like I said, there is a lot of gender inequality. I think from a woman's female's perspective is that she believes that if her husband is martyred, it'll be a freeway ticket to heaven, right? They'll be catapulted. So they've got this distorted things. They understand that the guilt issue of women really plays well. They'll play on the propaganda of, look, what's happening to our children. You know, they've been massacred around the world. They play on that because women have this caring, nurturing, generally, you know, this thing about themselves where they do care about the general thing. So to actually see that image, it will mess up your head. And then you want to safeguard your progeny. The fact that your Islam is going to be threatened, so you would want to be part of a system that will so-called look after and protect your honor, but on the price of the Yazidi girls. And I don't understand. Looking at the plight of these Yazidi girls, how can these sisters, you know, tolerate that? It's just beyond comprehension. But like Shiraz and Ilyas were stating, and the sister was stating, that once you're in that mode, you're in that robotic mode, you're functioning, forget everything else. And that's where the ISIS will play. They'll play on that thing, that it's your responsibility. And there's double pressure on women, because women generally are pressured anyway. You've got to be the best wife, you've got to be the best thing. And another thing, look, what would you choose? A husband who's just a hardworking breadwinner, who probably works wherever, mundane 9-to-5 job, your life is so boring, or someone with a gun, someone who's going to be perceived. This is true. I'm sorry, but this is a true factor. You know, so it's the image. We're looking at the understanding of these young girls. What do I want? But it's also this distorted belief that I want to go into the hereafter with my husband.
Melanie Woodard, what are the women finding? Come to you in a moment. But what are the women finding once they, or the girls finding once they get there?
We did a big portion of our most recent report about that, about kind of exposing the negativity. Because actually, having monitored some of these women for around a year and a half now, you can tell the changes in their narratives so easily. Different languages, just different words that they're using can make something seem much more negative. And from about October last year, when we saw a very big spike of women leaving in terms of numbers, and we think that was probably to do with Baghdadi's speech calling for women and calling for qualified people, like you say. Around that time, there started to be a lot of negativity online, a lot of phrases that if you kind of just take a step back and look at the underneath layer, things like, the winter's coming here, but I gave it all up for the sake of Allah. So I'm comfortable with that.
I think that's...
There's no Wi-Fi. Like, there's 15-year-old girls who are trying to climb to the top of trees to use their smartphones. Mm. And they tell those stories, and they're very funny. But as soon as you kind of take that top layer off, you're thinking, you know, some of these women are scared for their children. There's airstrikes going on, and they're talking about reaching for a suicide belt that they have by their bed rather than be killed by...
And also, once they have children, they're even more trapped than they were before they had the children and arrived there.
I think what you're saying, when you said, for the sake of Allah, that sums it up for me. Because that is the only motivating factor for when I was a Muslim, that I was doing it purely for that sake and nothing else matters. You know, you can have all these luring factors and this and that, but if you have that conviction that you're doing it for the sake of God, you can do anything. And that's what, from the rudimentary understanding I have of Saddam Hussein's Iraqi regime, he started to Islamicize the army, and that gave them that bit more. They go the extra mile. They go further if you say you're doing it for the sake of God. And that is what they do. Everything is for the sake of Allah. They romanticize it. I'm here. I'm sacrificing for the sake of Allah. And you're like, wow, you know, that's what am I doing in this country? You know, I might have a job in McDonald's for the weekend. And it's just, I want to do something which is bigger than this life. And you have to have that mindset where you have that belief that there is a life after this and nothing matters here. And they play on that as well. Like, look, leaving your mother, you know, one girl that I met, she told me when she was in the private chat rooms with these girls saying, don't worry, it'll be hard to leave your mum, but don't worry, you're doing it for the sake of Allah. You know, don't worry if your mum's upset, you know, you're doing it for a greater good. and that consumes them, and that is what they believe in. That is wholeheartedly why a young girl of 13 years old can get on a plane. And mum told me that she was even scared to go upstairs, so she doesn't understand how this girl got on a plane. So this is so powerful, and we can't underestimate the techniques ISIS are using. They're very sophisticated. The virtual friendships that these girls have, they were like, I don't even feel like I'm alone. I felt like I had this, you know, imaginary friend with me all the way to the airport, telling me which bar to go to, telling me which, you know, where to meet, and I'll meet a friend there, and I didn't feel alone. And this hypnotic state that they managed to get these girls into is phenomenal. I mean, I'm learning on the job. I've you know, can decipher certain things that are happening, and this is the main thing. They all feel almost hypnotized by the way ISIS are managing to, you know, fantastically get into their heads and mess their minds up.
Well, I think the point you were making about religion is the point that David Cameron was making to some extent this week around how we can't extricate Islam from extremism, and to do so wouldn't be right. And he's talked a lot about his four pillars of a five-year strategy to take on radicalization and extremism. Just to move forward, and just before we go to questions, can you just very briefly, and feel free to all pitch in, what needs to be done? How do we stop women from getting involved with this movement? Who wants to go first?
Well, one of the things, just building on what everyone's saying, is that, you know, when I call them the war on terror generation, which is, you know, the young people that we have, all their formative years have just been set in this war on terror paradigm since, you know, 2001. Every day they have this, what I said, daily diet of death and hypocrisy. And now with their social media feeds, it's 24/7 for them. And they're exposed to things that, you know, are uncensored, and there's no counter narrative, and there's no, and then there's the disconnect that they have with imams, with their parents, with teachers, with schools. And it's really the online space and their kind of peer group, which really is their kind of primary kind of education meeting, and they're self-educating really. So therefore, you know, there is an element of trauma kind of, I see it from as a psychologist, you know, I have to say that, in all the cases that I've worked with over the years, there's always some emotional well-being issues. And as a community, not just as a Muslim community, but also on the mainstream with all our young people, we don't actually nurture their emotional well-being well. Okay, that's why they lead these kind of double lives. More so, I think, in the Muslim community, where the kind of emotional well-being support is perhaps even less. So there is an element of kind of trauma, of time, emotional well-being issues that sometimes expose. And I think in terms of solutions, for us, you know, one of them is obviously on a kind of, and a bigger kind of policy level, is we've got to change the paradigm. And I'm sick and tired of this debate. I've been to hundreds and hundreds over the years, and no one is solution focused. And even David Cameron's speech is just saying the same thing that we've just heard, maybe a bit more nuanced every time. Okay, but where's the solutions? And where's really the kind of, the transformation only comes when we recognize that on a completely societal level, every single one of us has a role to play in terms of the push and the pull factors, whether it's Islamophobia growing in British society that we turn a blind eye, or the push factors down to the war on terror and drone attacks, and then the pull factors in terms of ideology and the need for the Muslim community to kind of deal with that reality. Every one of us has to play our role. We've got to change the paradigm, and we've got to create a paradigm which humanizes, I think, and dignifies people. And one of the things that's building on that is that young people look out in the war on terror paradigm and they don't see any moral high ground. That's how I see it. And the young people are like, we don't see any moral high ground. So ISIS is just equivalent to the rest. And they just happen to connect better with us. Sometimes it's kind of as simple as that.
One technique that I see all the extremist groups have used is making everything very black and white. So you're with this camp or you're with none. And, you know, even Shura said that you fell for that when Bush said as well. We need to make sure that people don't feel it is one camp or the other. There is extremism, whether that's far-right extremism, terrorism, you know, nasty rubbish that's going on, or people who are against that. Now, the Muslim community dynamics, there isn't one Muslim community. I remember back in the day, there was like one person, like Inayat Bungalowala or someone on TV, and it just like wouldn't.
And the Muslim Council of Britain.
Yeah, and they are like, what are they doing on TV? You know, it's like, didn't represent, you know, the Muslim communities at all. And now there are more personalities coming up. Like, you know, I really want to promote Zahra Khan because she's you know,
Inspire.
Yeah, from Inspire, she's taking them head on. But, you know, she's one camp. Then other camps are, you know, dissing her, and then, you know, everyone's like fighting. So the Muslim communities are just so fractured, and they're not united in any way. We need to, yes, when Cameron said we need to address that, yes, they do. But we have to also start promoting the different ideas, and there's no rush, or there's no necessity to belong to one camp or the other. You have to decide and look at what's out there and find your...
Okay, so let me just tell you about some of the things that he said need to be done. So he says we need to de-glamorise this movement. We need to espouse liberal movements versus Islamic extremism. Work with people to understand what life is like under ISIS, to really understand the brutal reality of this ideology, and to have specific de-radicalisation programmes that would be set up, which would be different, presumably, to what there is already in place. And he also wants internet companies to start thinking about tackling extremism online. What else would you add to that?
I would add education. I know he's brought in a statutory requirement so that we have prevention lessons in schools across the UK. And people are kind of fumbling around now to find the materials because they're not things that have been properly developed yet. But those types of programs tackle every form of extremism. So if we want to extrapolate it from Islamist extremism, you know, far-right extremism does rise when Islamist extremism does. They work in tandem. Islamophobia is a thing. That's also very important to educate people about. And these programs were brought in... When I was at school, I remember having citizenship lessons, or PSHE, yes. I think they were called.
They still do them.
And we had these lessons about gangs and sex ed and drugs. And presumably, education has a very large role to play in just slotting something in there about counter-extremism, counter-radicalisation. And it sounds so simple, but it hasn't been done yet.
Shiraz?
Can I just quickly just on that?
We need to go to Shiraz. You can come back later. Yeah. Shiraz.
Well, I mean, the takeaway point from all of this is that there's no quick fix to any of this. And I think that's the real bottom line. You are going to continue to see people going to Syria from this country, from Europe, for years. That is not indicative of there being a failure in terms of the other side of this debate. It's just that the policies are very, very slow. Ultimately, when we talk about identity and building a cohesive society, giving people that sense of reassurance about their place in society, you know, that takes years and years. It takes a generation. So all of that will take a lot of time to get people into this space about feeling like they belong. In the immediate short term, those policies that Cameron actually suggested, I think, are ultimately pretty good in the short term in terms of if you do de-glamorize ISIS, if you do show the reality of life under there. Look, there are British citizens who have fought with ISIS who are now back in Turkey, who are stuck in limbo because they don't want to return here, they go to Belmarsh, but they are totally disillusioned. Now, I've personally gone into Downing Street and repeatedly said, give a couple of those guys who haven't done the most terrible things an amnesty to come back. Because, frankly, if we go around to school to say, you know, I used to be in Hizb ut-Tahrir, it's not taken seriously by them, right? It might impress a Guardian crowd, but it doesn't impress the kid in Bradford who's thinking about going to Dola. That's the bottom line. And what you really need is a guy to come back from Raqqa and say, I spent a year there. Let me tell you about the winter without the heating. Let me tell you about this. You know, life sucks. It does suck. But if you go online and you look at it, it looks glamorous. So I constantly say this, it's not a soft policy, it's a smart policy. You need to get some of these guys back. They're the powerful vehicles for doing it.
Yasmin, final word from you.
I think you just need human touch, to be honest, human engagement. In this digitalized world, we become very like, you know, oh, we've got to I really hate this term, de-radicalization, because I find it's very scientific, and these are people. We need to sort of engage now, provide them some kind of like platform. Where's the basic youth work? Where was that detach and outreach work? This is the same strategy that this group will use, ISIS group will use, meet them at the cafe. You need to use that now. It's not on virtual, it's not only virtual. We need to start interacting, bring them in. I remember one imam who stayed the whole night with the youth, and there was like a couple of sessional workers, just to get him out of the gang. And this is what I call good youth work. And this is what I call good grass community work.
The problem is the budgets have been cut. We just don't have the money for that kind of work.
Do it from your
last word and then the audience.
From like almost a pilot thing, because this is a new thing that's been happening with Channel. The girls that I meet, I've had to continuously keep that rapport with them, make them feel that I care about them. You know, think about education, do a lot of mentoring work with the girls to the extent where, you know, they've gone back into society and realised, I'm so glad I didn't go on that plane. I'm so glad I've come back. I don't know if I can share with you something. One of the girls, now she's been de-radicalized. I don't know how I'm going to say it, but like,
humanized.
She's realized that whatever she's done was a bad decision, and she's happy. I keep calling her a 13-year-old, but I'm like mothering her a bit. She wrote a poem. I suggested, why don't you draw something? Why don't you write something to, like, an antidote? And I've got her poem. I don't know if you want to read it or if you want me to read it out to see straight from the horse's mouth what these girls think.
Is it long?
Nope.
Okay, great. Why don't you do that while we'll get it out while I just get the first question from the audience. Anybody want to ask a question? Yes. Do you want to just wait for the microphone? It's just coming over.
You talked a lot...
Is it on?
Yep.
Oh. You talked a lot about people and their peers and how a lot of their school friends were sort of radicalising them. And I was wondering how their parents and your parents reacted when you were radicalised.
Who did you want to ask that question to?
Anyone.
Who wants to take it?
Well, you know what's interesting is, again, part of the process is actually they want to split that link with your family. It's part of the us versus them. It's part of you being part of this unique, special group. Your family is not part of that group unless they obviously share the ideology. And I, you know, I'm quite embarrassed to admit that at one point I actually had a fight with my dad. I had lots of issues with my dad anyway, but this gave me even more legitimacy. And I actually said to him, and it's terrible to admit it, I will kill you. Okay, so that's the kind of fracture that they create between father and son. And they use religious narrative to do it. This great story of here, and this father killed his son, and son killed his father because he was a disbeliever. So, you know, that's what's happened. But in the other scene, so that's my kind of terrible case here, and there are lots of others similar to that, because there are those fractures already there. But in a lot of cases, the parents are oblivious. Okay, because they're oblivious. Oh, my son's he's hanging out with these nice Muslim boys and girls, and he's going to the mosque more often, and not with the drug dealing kids and spliff smoking kids elsewhere, and he's not talking back, and he's really respectful, because they'll tell you, you know, be really good to your parents because you want to bring them on board and all that kind of stuff. So in a lot of cases, parents are oblivious, but the real oblivion becomes because of the complete disconnect. Because from a very young age, I've got to say, my example, we learn to lead a double life. We have our respectable home life, and then we've got our hidden clandestine existence where we're up to all kinds of mischief. So in most cases, we hide things really well, you know.
I think young people are great at doing that as well. Sorry.
Just make a really quick point based on what Ilyas was saying, which is they build Islam as something completely exclusive, right? Nothing can be like Islam. Therefore, the more tension you feel with everything around you, by definition, the closer you're getting to authentic Islam. So you walk down the street and you think, I hate this society, I don't like living here. But that inside you think, I'm becoming a better Muslim, I'm getting closer to true Islam. So when you're in that state of conflict, it's reinforcing the sort of authenticity of your position. And that tension is actually a source of support for you. So it's great when you're in conflict with your parents, with society, with everything around you, because you feel like you're getting closer to authentic Islam.
It's just really very sophisticated psychological grooming.
No, it's not. It's not sophisticated. It's just basic cognitive dissonance. Everyone has it.
That sounds quite sophisticated.
Okay, what it is, everyone has it, which is that the more you're right, you know, either I'm wrong or all the persecution I'm getting just reaffirms that I am right. Mm. I am supreme. I'm significant. I'm unique. I am the chosen ones. We used to have this song. It's "We Are the Chosen Ones." We are the chosen ones. It's on YouTube, by the way, yeah. So, and we loved it. The more people hated us, you're absolutely right. The more it kind of fed into it. Well, this is part of being estranged and unique.
The Ghuraba.
Yeah, Ghuraba, yeah.
Want to do a rendition now?
What is that? I secretly do it. We are the Jews.
We're going to get a poem, a song. I'll juggle it.
Do you want to read your poem and we'll take another question?
Yeah, so this girl, she was stopped off the plane, and I've been in touch with her continuously since that time. And I've used her poem in a school setting as well with some other kids, and it was really, like you said, it has to come from the people who's experienced it. And this is her poem. They took me towards a path I'm glad I never went down. At first it was a paradise, a place where all my dreams were to come true. I was told I'd live like a princess, but it was all a trap I was falling into, thinking it's an adventure, painting over the real picture, avoiding the truth. With their lies, I was drowning deep, convinced I was picking a rose without any thorns, coating every fault, assuming I was gathering fresh honey from a hive, thinking the bees will not bite. With their bribes, I was led astray, I was believing everything said, not knowing I had lost my mind, till I finally realised what I was thinking at the time. Knowing I was not all there, the escape route was fading, yet still visible. Now was my chance to stay away from this nightmare. How could I ever let this disaster ever happen? So, yeah, I mean, she's expressed herself through that poetry. And this girl, I've, you know, tried to get her to have an outlet now, as because now she's feeling angry about what had happened to her. Mm. And she's like, let's make hashtag say no to ISIS, because this is the whole thing, hashtag this, hashtag that, you know, this is their world. We can't quite grasp the advancement of technology. You know, she's telling me about these SureSpot, Kick, Instagram, Snapchat, this is in today, out tomorrow, Facebook's for old people. You know, like, you know, this, she's telling me what we have no clue about, and her parents definitely had no clue about it. So it's getting to, there's parts of it there, ISIS and, you know, the tech-savvy people out there know exactly what they're doing, and they're on the platforms our children are at, and we're not anywhere to be seen.
They have a very sophisticated media machine.
Absolutely.
There's a question over there.
Yeah. It's what I'd like to ask is, because it seems to me from what I've heard, especially from the gentleman over there...
Alias.
Alias and the lady...
Yasmin.
It seems to me either between... Well, a sort of cross between Islam, the International Brigade, and punk rock.
Yes,
just,
yes.
You
absolutely.
Know, fuck
absolutely.
Off. I am going to the Pistols concert tonight. I don't give a shit what you say, you know? And is it hormonal? Is it teenage? Which is something you can never really cure. Cure? Well, everybody's just got to go through it, you know? Or, with regards to the women, and I see that the ladies, they choose to wear hijabs, but I cannot help but think... I mean, look, it's tough for women everywhere, whereas boys can go down the pub, you know, and dad will say, do you need a tenner? It's, you're not going out like that, missy, you know, to the girls.
So but is it teenage just, hormones, or is it...
Or is it a repressive culture, which I see in Islamic culture, or shall we say, is families who... First generation families
okay.
who
I think
have
we
come over
the
here.
Question. Thank you. Who
okay?
wants to take that?
And please don't feel bad about threatening to kill your dad. Last time I threatened to kill him was Saturday afternoon. All right?
Thank you. Is it teenage hormones or is it a repressive culture?
I think the repressive culture question doesn't necessarily take into account the converts or the reverts or whatever you want to call them. Mm. Because if you're saying that repressive culture is attributed to first, second generation Islamic families, that doesn't quite match up in my mind. There's a lot of the girls that I've monitored for 6-7 months who come from very big British families. There's actually the 45-year-old that we have in our database. It was from Kent, and she went to marry a 20-year-old guy, which is an outlier, I'll give you that. But she is definitely not a product of that repression or a product of...
And half my cases are converts as well.
Yeah.
I'm a convert too, so I used to go to Quaker school and totally not involved in
it. And like we were saying, converts always want to get it right. Mm. They want to do everything kind of, if somebody gets there first and they say, this is what's right for you, this is how you should convert, this is the type of Islam that you should practice.
They got there first.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Sorry, go.
Can I just add, I think there's an identity where you do have to leave your nationality, ethnicity, so it's a freedom from breaking from that culture or that ethnicity. And the reason why I speak is from my experience, we weren't allowed to identify ourselves as Asians. You had to say that your great-grandmother and granddad was Adam and Eve. I couldn't talk about being British. So yes, I think there is that thing that you want to escape into a new identity. Now, when you're talking about my hijab, well, if I took it off, this is my prevention, because I think I'll scare all of you. I've got very bad hairstyle. Okay? But I'm a Muslim feminist, so I'm determined to keep that. But anyway, when it comes to hormones, it's just the fact of developing minds. As human beings, we're always evolving. right? We're always like changing our opinions, we're always doing that. So I'm hoping that these people will start to think a bit more open. But yes, you can't be limited in that way of thinking for a long, long time. It will only be the leaders. But I don't think these grassroots people would adhere to that ideology for a long time. I mean, look at us, we finally came out by the grace of God, and many, many have come out, but we've still got a long way to go.
Shiraz?
I was just going to say, it touches on something Ilyas was saying in your initial remarks, which is a lot of young people want to change the world. A lot of young people believe they will change the world and they can do that. And that was certainly, you know, what was running through my head. You know, 20 years old, in Hizb ut-Tahrir, post 9/11, and Kofi Annan is talking about Hizb ut-Tahrir at the UN. You're like, wow, you know, we're important. You know, we matter, right? Now you imagine, one of the guys I used to talk to a lot was a 25-year-old who went from Portsmouth, used to work at Primark as a middle manager, right? And is now in ISIS, running around, winning all these battles, getting all these victories. Obama's got headaches based on what he's doing. You know, it's a lot more glamorous than working at Primark. That's the reality. Mm. So in that sense, it is just a bit of what you were saying, young hormones, sort of, you know, we're going to change the world, and, you know, I've worked it all out. And I often say about myself, and I'll speak just for myself, 9/11 was my moment. If I'd been older, I could have easily joined the militant tendency or something like that, because a lot of our criticisms of Western society were just standard anti-capitalist leftist analysis of capitalism is exploitative and it's terrible. At the same time, if I'd been younger, I honestly look at these guys in ISIS and think I could have easily been in ISIS.
Okay, any other questions?
Just quickly.
Look, we've got a few. Right, you'll get a chance to make your points. Let's take the one at the back, but I will keep you two in mind.
Hi. My question is really based on crossover. So it's something that Shiraz had mentioned about big concepts like Khilafah being used as umbrella terms and the way that they can be manipulated to lead to extremism. But my, my question is, where is the kind of, I guess in terms of a grey area. So, for example, you'll have like very conservative Muslims who will say things like, or who will agree with terms like, you know, national identity is something that's a little bit redundant, and we believe that as Muslims we're one big family, we're one big ummah, and in some ways they see that as a good thing. There's other concepts as well which kind of relate to that. So I guess to put it in quite simple terms, what happens if you are a religious Muslim who believes in some of the similar things that the guys in ISIS promote, but don't want to be manipulated to the point where you actually end up joining? Where's that crossover? And do you believe that there is a certain degree of danger when the government like uses these terms as perhaps indicators to say that you might be on the road to extremism? And I hope that makes sense.
It does. Who did you want to ask that question of?
Anyone, but I guess Shiraz to start with. I don't know.
Shiraz?
Well, thanks. Look, you know, you say, what if you believe in sort of vaguely the same things as some of the things ISIS believe in? All of us believe in some of the exact same things. We believe in Allah, right? We believe in the Quran. So we believe in certain things. But, you know, like you mentioned, the term Khilafah, I mean, it's so broad to be meaningless. You actually mentioned Ummah as well. How do you define the Ummah, right? So these are all highly contested terms. And the problem with a group like Islamic State is that it says, these are not contested. We've got a sort of definition of what it means, and guess what? It just happens to be these very draconian and esoteric definitions that they've brought to the fore. In terms of, you know, how then the government tries to do this, I agree. There's some difficulty around this. Look, we should not confuse Islamic conservatism with Islamic extremism. Lots of people live very conservative lives. Good for them. They are productive, normal, ordinary members of our society. And that's the beauty of secular states, right? That we allow people to do these things. That's the whole reality with ISIS. And I think that's actually where Cameron missed the trick. And what was otherwise a very, very good speech is when he talks about values, actually he should have talked about secularism, saying, look, this is precisely what allows you to have the masjid, to have the beard and do this. And I'll just finish with this point. He could have turned this right around. The Luton family that went issued a statement about their decision to go, and they said, despite everything the British government did, we never allowed them to wash away our Islam. And it would have been so easy for David Cameron to say, let's talk about who's washing away Islam. Right? Where are all the Sufi shrines in Syria now, in the ISIS territory, bulldozed? Who's bombing the Shia mosques? ISIS. Right? If you want to talk about washing away Islam, it's ISIS that's washing away Islam, not the British government.
Okay, let's take another question here.
Thanks. This is for the women, Melanie and Yasmin, and I forgot your name. The name
Salma.
We're with. Thank you. I get that the whole idea of a macho man with a gun is really appealing to these women, but I think, as Alias was saying, we have all basic needs. One of the most basic, I think, female needs is, although you want this hot guy to do that, you also kind of want him to yourself. You don't want to share him with other wives or slave girls. First of all, right? That's a very common, I think, woman experience. What are these girls saying? Do they feel the same way? Do they like it when they go over there? What's that all about?
I can't exactly speak from the interaction, but when it comes to like sharing your husband, again, it goes back to like, look, I'm doing it for the sake of God, okay? I'm sacrificing my husband for the sake of God, for another woman. Now, I don't know whether there are some bitch fits over there. I really don't know. I'm sure there are, okay? But on the true, yeah, on the serious note, there are the issues, because look, you're killing yourself, right? You're killing who you are. And now you're transitioning to what you're becoming. So therefore, whatever you feel is nothing now. It's oblivious because you're in that mindset, I'm sacrificing, I'll give my nights up to my husband, you know, for another woman to take my husband, because I've just got to be patient. And that, in that understanding, is known to be the good wife in that context. But me as a Muslim feminist, I'm different. My man's my man.
Melanie and then Salma.
I actually have seen that happen with the younger girls. I think it's perhaps easier to get your head around that understanding that you have to share, and that ideologically that's totally fine, if not encouraged. But some of the younger girls will occasionally write blog posts about it. There was a 16-year-old German girl that wrote a blog post the other day, which was pretty amazing on the topic. And she was saying, you know, it's this for the sake of Allah. It's, you need to understand that this is something that's going to be good for you and will make you closer to Allah and is going to make you a better Muslim. So it's just framing everything in that context and having the conviction that that's what you want that works. But let me tell you, there are some bitch fits.
I was going to say.
Oh, yeah.
Go on, Salma.
Definite bitch fit. There's this phrase that when I was back in that mindset was, this life is a prison for the believers, for the believers, and paradise for the disbelievers. I used to keep having to say that to myself. What does it mean? It's a prison for the believers. I'm meant to be, you know, upset and angry and frustrated in this life and feel like I'm in a prison. So again, that's good. And whenever there is a conflict or a difficulty, you tell yourself this phrase. So in that sense, I suppose what it's definitely is being portrayed by these girls from writing blogs and saying you're doing it for the sake of Allah. So I'm sure they use that same phrase as well for themselves. And secondly, the luring factor. I think they massively lie to the girls, obviously. You know, one girl was told it was like, she ended up thinking it was an Islamic Disneyland she was going to go to. She actually used that phrase. She thought, I was going to an Islamic Disneyland. I was like, whoa, that's, yeah. But it gave the example very clearly of what she thought she was heading towards. So what they do is they tell you everything you want to know. And what you want, they make that your utopia. So there's nothing wrong with it. There's absolutely zero problems. Okay, it might be a little bit hot, but that's a bit, you know, that's it. One girl, she was like, I don't want to get married, but can I become a doctor over there? And they're like, yeah, of course you can. There's universities, you can become a doctor. You know, one's like, I've always wanted to be an ambulance driver. You know, yeah, come and be an ambulance. Everything is a yes. Everything that you want, all your hopes, your desires, your dreams is a yes. You want a husband? Yes. You want free house? Yes. Everything is given in that way, the rosy picture. Like the little girl was saying, I was fooled. And that's what they're clever at doing. And they'll show Twitter pictures of fancy food that's out there and delicious dinner. They'll show a picture of, you know, the hospitals and beautiful shopping malls. We don't know where they're from, but they will be giving them these pictures in the private chat rooms, and they'll feel that it's real.
Okay, let's see if we can get a couple more questions, and then there's one here and one over there.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hey, on that point that you just said, about, yeah, straight up, like, just lying, and how often, like, some of the women are more ideologically inclined because they're not, like, macho and they're like, yeah, we want to, like, die in battle. So would you say that ISIS sell it to these women by saying, yeah, like you can have a legitimate intellectual, yeah, an intellectual legitimacy, and then when they get there, then they enter into the kind of, like, they almost become a currency for these, like, gang members? Would you say that was, like, a correct thing to say?
Well, from the, you know, we're still learning. We don't actually know exactly what's going on out there. But from what I've managed to, you know, decipher is that there is an army of young women who work day in, day out, 24 hours a day, around the clock, just completely online. And they will say whatever it takes to get any young person or anybody over to join ISIS. So they would, yeah, completely lie. And when they're out there, from the other bits of information I've got, is that they will be then made to train and recruit other young people, and that's what their life will be. They're in houses, they're in, you know, in little flats or whatever it is. I'm in touch with Amira Abbas's family, and her parents were, you know, quite shocked at the fact that her daughter got married to the ginger.
Can you explain who she is?
Huh?
Can you explain who she
Amira
is?
Amira Abbas is one of the three girls from Bethnal Green School. She's married a ginger jihadi from butcher guy from Australia. So maybe, you know, she's being very vocal and open about her life. And again, this is a propaganda for young girls. Like, oh yeah, well, I'll get my, you know, jihadi husband, and I'll be able to live a life there. She even though you're saying they're not allowed to fight, she's still coming across as very militant. And they, you know, even some of the pictures, the women have got Kalashnikovs as well. So if that tick floats your boat, then they've got Kalashnikovs, we've got hospitals, we've got restaurants, you know, whatever tickles your fancy, we've got it. It's that. Sometimes basic, okay. In a sense.
Question, then a question at the back. Yes.
Hi, I just wondered if you've come into contact with any women who've gone to join ISIS, who've become so delusioned with it that they've somehow managed to escape, go to other parts of Europe, maybe even come back to Britain. I don't know if that's a complete impossibility in itself, but whether you've been in contact with any women like that.
Melanie or Summer?
There's, I think, around 5 known cases of female returnees to Britain. And there's about another 5 who are kind of floating around Europe. I know from some of the cases that have returned, obviously there's a legal protection issue. I would love to interview them, for one, but that's fairly impossible. And as we were saying earlier, the narratives of formers, of people who have literally spent time in the region and have changed their minds, there's nothing more powerful than that. So there are a few cases. There's quite a well-known case, actually, of a woman called Tarina Shakil, who went with her child, and the whole story is that she escaped, broke into the place where her passport was being kept, and ran to the border with the child strapped to her back. It's a very kind of Hollywood story, if you take it on that basis. But women return far less because their mobility is so impaired in the territory. They are not allowed to leave the house unsupervised and without prior permission. So, very hard, very, very hard. And once you have children, even more difficult because you have that family structure.
Okay.
It's hard for the men to escape, let alone the women.
Yeah. Mm.
Can I get a question from the back? I saw someone with their hands up at the back.
Hi. I was just thinking about that point of education that you were making and how many victims there are, such as children in Syria who've been raped, who probably won't be able to have their own children because of what has happened to them by these men who are discovering their masculinity. And I'm just wondering if information about those children could be brought into schools.
See, one of the big problems with any kind of education is that, you know, the disaffected, disempowered, angry, frustrated mindset already believes it's propaganda. So you just don't believe it. And one of the things they consistently get from the social media fuels is don't believe what they're telling you about Islamic State. This all lies. It's not really like that here. So that's, and I get that nearly every day from young people who I have this discussion with all the time. So that's part of the problem. And then, again, part of the problem is what I say in terms of counter messaging, having credible people doing it. And I have to say that I'm very critical of a lot of what I call the prevent industry. I choose to be non-governmental because I don't want to be part of that, you know, because I feel that it just promotes a particular kind of narrative rather than what I think, you know, working and having a conversation and having building a connection with young people and not criminalizing them or labeling them or stigmatizing them. I remember once I was in Berlin with the violence prevention network there. They worked with neo-Nazis in prisons. And I asked them, what's your DRAD program? And they said, what DRAD program? We just have a conversation with people. And our people that do the conversations are very credible. There's compassion, there's humanity, and they connect with them on a human level. That's what it's about. So I think what's more important in the education process is, and of course, you know, I do a lot around sex. Most of my work is on sexual violence prevention now with young men. And I bring lots of these stories, not just around what's happening in Syria, but on a global level around 1 in 3 women are victims of sexual violence and what's going on. So all of that is really important. But I think what's the most critical part of this whole process, and I think we're still not there, is we need to open the space rather than close the space. Everything that we've been doing is closing the space and pushing people underground and in ungoverned spaces.
To allow the victims and their families to talk about what's happened to them.
They're also...
It is happening. It is happening, but I think at the hard end, where, you know, I'm really talking about a disaffected mindset, it doesn't work. Mm. See, and we've got to be... Yes, it's really important at the, I think, upstream, what I call the wannabe, gonna-be stage, but I call it got to be become too far gone, no return stage. The further we go down the continuum, it becomes a bit harder and harder. So absolutely, yes, it works in schools. There's some good work in Birmingham at the moment where there, I think there are some Syrian refugees and Yazidi women who have gone into schools and they've spoken about their experience. Harrowing, and it's really had an impact on that mindset. So yeah, absolutely, it has a space to do that. But, you know, in terms of those who are most at risk, this is the key thing. This ungoverned space that no one really enters into and very few of us have credibility in, that's a space we've got to crack. Okay, and I think that's difficult to do without us. What we've done is we've closed it down too much. I think we now need a process of opening up the space. You know, if I give one example, I went to school in the 80s. My history teacher encouraged me to become a member of the PLO. Okay, and I'd come in with my PLO staff and everything else. Yeah, great. You know, we had a lively discussion. We spoke about the issues, the complexity of the Arab-Israeli conflict, et cetera, et cetera. That's opening up the space, I think, yeah. You know, and I think, I'm not saying we go that far, but can you see, I think that there's an important need to open up the space, really.
Okay. Well,
I was hoping...
Can you make it brief? We have to wrap up really, really in a couple of minutes.
Okay, sorry. I've got a career on hold. I was hoping to be a citizenship studies teacher because I feel that this is one of the most important areas of education. I have been into schools as well. I've been told some of the information I've given is too graphic, so a lot of the teachers are not sure what to show teacher students and what's appropriate and what's not. But what I really want to happen is a mix of the extremist views on show. So it's not just Yazidi slave women, but, like, you know, what about far-right extremism? So there's the people there don't feel targeted because they will fundamentally, and, you know, they will feel that they're targeted if they're Muslims in the audience. But if you say this is a problem in society, hatred, anger, these are things that are negative, but we can do something positive, you know, bring a lot of positivity with young children. It works amazingly. So these, you know, shock tactics do work, but they have to be in conjunction with other subjects as well that don't just, pick just out one type of community.
Okay, well, look, thank you very much, and thank you to all of you. But particularly thank you to my panel, who are courageous and brave and wanting to speak about this. And I'd say in particular the two women for whom this is not an easy step.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.